I don't know about you, but I can remember where I was and what I was doing when the news of 9/11 came out. I heard it first on the radio, but it wasn't until I watched the news and saw the footage and I saw pictures of victims, of survivors, of rescuers, and of the debris that I started to understand the impact of what happens when a plane hits the World Trade Center. Words are powerful, but images are where information starts to move from up here down into our heart and we start to engage with things. And so I'm going to encourage you, as we reflect on this passage, to use your imagination. Because I sort of guess that if you're anything like me, this is a passage that you've skim read in the past, possibly because it doesn't seem that relevant, and often because it raises difficult and uncomfortable questions. How can God abandon his people? Why do people follow evil and reject what is good? Why do the innocent suffer? What about all of the promises that we hear that God makes about rescue and redemption and everlasting love? Because in chapter 10, we read that God is angry at the leaders or the shepherds of the people, for those who have caused his people to be oppressed and scattered. And God is going to remedy the situation by gathering the people to himself. And so we read those promises of restoration and redemption and strengthening. And then in chapter 11, we see Zechariah being asked to act out two very symbolic parables. In a nutshell, God asks Zechariah to act out the part of a good shepherd who is rejected by those he's seeking to care for. And then he's asked to act out the part of a bad shepherd who is appointed as a punishment because they rejected the good shepherd. So that's that summary of that passage. And as we look at it, I'm really going to encourage you to use your imagination, because when I started to imagine Zechariah acting this out with a flock of sheep, which it has to be said, there's quite a lot of artistic license, because I've never seen sheep expressing any emotion, let alone hatred, and never seen them learn how to negotiate a price when they sack a shepherd. They've obviously not been to any HR training. But when we take it to that level, and then to take it to a deeper level of imagining it with people as the flock and the shepherds, that it became more relevant and uncomfortable and challenging. It's a little bit like reading Romeo and Juliet, because I think Shakespeare is most powerful when the plays are dramatised in different settings. Think of the power of Romeo and Juliet if it's dramatised in Germany in 1939, with the main players being a Nazi and a Jew, or in Rwanda, a Hutu and a Tutsi. Or think of the Irish, the Troubles, and you've got that divide of two young people, one Protestant and one Catholic. Suddenly it gets more real. You get to the real issues, don't you? And that's what I want you to do as you read, as we go through this. So as we go through, first Zechariah plays the role of a good shepherd, and in that he's representing God in the things that he says and does. He's told to act as a good shepherd to a flock which was marked for slaughter, because their own shepherds who had responsibility for them had sold them to merchants who were only interested in their meat. But even worse, it wasn't just the shepherds who were exploiting the sheep, but the sheep, or the people, were exploiting and destroying each other. God speaks his judgment on them. "For I will no longer have pity on them. I will give everyone into the hands of their neighbour and their king. They," that's the neighbours and king, "will devastate the land, and I will not rescue them." Essentially, the people will be abandoned by God and their land destroyed. Within the flock, there are a group who are termed the oppressed. And it's really clear that they are true victims because they're suffering because of the wrongdoing of others. But the shepherd, God, knows that they're innocent. He knows who they are. And for their sake, the punishment, the slaughter is delayed. And for a time, the good shepherd, God, gets rid of the bad shepherds, the bad leaders, and looks after the flock himself. He takes two staffs. He takes favour and he takes union. And together, they represent the completeness of what life in a covenant relationship with God is like. That whole sense of shalom, of wholeness. Favour represents the beauty of God, that blessing of undeserved grace and relationship. Union represents the bond and unity which binds people together, and in this case, the two kingdoms of Judah and Israel. God, the shepherd, is a good shepherd, and particularly he cares for the oppressed sheep. And he shows the rest what it's like to be cared for, to be looked after, to be protected. God was giving them an opportunity to turn and follow him because he was good compared to the other leaders who were bad. But the flock reject the shepherd. And this wasn't a passive ignoring or a mild dislike, but the text says that they detested him. To detest. It's to more than hate. It's to loathe. One definition says that it feels an intense and often violent antipathy. There's a real gut thing in it. And it is because the flock reject the shepherd that he reaches the end of the line, gives up, and walks away, leaving them to die. In effect, God abandons his people. He breaks the covenant relationship with them. And Zechariah demonstrates this by taking the first staff, favour, and breaking it. The words are vivid. Let the dying die, the perishing perish, and those who are left eat each other's flesh. And that latter came to pass because in 587 BC there was such a severe famine during a prolonged siege of Jerusalem before it fell, that it was reported that parents ate their own children in order to survive. We read it in Lamentations. Lord, Lord, and consider whom have you treated like this? Should women eat their offspring, the children they have cared for? It's horrible, isn't it? It's grotesque. It's vivid. And those who were oppressed, those who were the victims, they looked on and watched, acknowledging that God had spoken. The shepherd, God, asks the flock for severance pay if they want to give something. And when they pay 30 pieces of silver, God is incensed and tells Zechariah to throw it at the money to the potter. 30 pieces of silver wasn't a low price. But the point made is that the shepherd, that God, regarded monetary payment from those who had rejected him as a huge insult. And secondly, the potter at the temple who made the ceremonial vessels used in worship. Well, the temple was the place where the bad leaders, the shepherds, had shown the most contempt for God. And I'm guessing that you're already thinking one step ahead to Jesus, who was betrayed for the price of 30 coins of silver. And the final act in this parable was the breaking of the covenant between Judah and Israel as Zechariah took the second staff unity and broke it. And that was a symbol that when the covenant with God is broken, there is also a breakdown of human relationship with the potential for devastating consequences. And we don't need to look far away to realise how true this is. In the second parable, Zechariah is told to play the part of a shepherd, not God, who doesn't care for the flock. who doesn't perform any of the functions of a shepherd to rescue or to look after the healthy or the vulnerable. A leader who was cruel, who didn't care, who neglected and who failed to protect, who deserted and devoured those who were placed under his care. Why? Why does this happen? Why did they have that punishment? Well, the text, Zechariah, makes it very clear it was because they rejected the good shepherd, God. They're paying the consequences, and this is the kind of leader that they deserved. Earlier chapters in this whole 9 to 11 part of Zechariah focused on the bad shepherds and real examples of bad leadership. And this passage starts to shine a spotlight on the flock, those who followed, as well as the good shepherd. And it raises that question to me, why do people follow bad leaders? They were so obviously bad leaders. If this flock, this group of people who knew that they were going to be slaughtered, that they were going to be punished, this group of people who'd been led badly by leaders who exploited them and helped them to exploit each other, who didn't fulfill their responsibilities, why, when they were led by this good shepherd who cared for them and provided for them, who looked after those in the most need and who protected them, who was good, well, why did they reject him? Why did they hate him? In fact, more than hate him, hate the very air he breathed. Because when the leadership that they'd experienced before was so toxic, why did they reject what was so completely opposite? There's some really complex psychology looking at the reasons that people follow bad or toxic leaders. Jean Lippman-Blumen, a psychologist, talks about followers enabling and assisting bad leaders because it gives them a sense of power. Bad followers, or henchmen, are drawn to bad leaders because they can share power. Bad leaders appeal to the deepest needs and play on anxieties and fears or yearnings for security, power, or significance. Toxic leaders charm, manipulate, mistreat weakness and ultimately devastate their followers. And I think we can see all of that in this passage, as well as contemporary society. Another reason is that we're good at normalising what should shock. Think of the photos of famine victims from Ethiopia in 1984. They had a profound impact. I remember them having a profound impact on me as a teenager. It led to Band-Aid and that song that we still play at Christmas time, even though the familiarity of the lyrics probably certainly takes away a lot of the impact. But you know, there have been famines since. There have been equally significant humanitarian disasters. And I'm sure that out of COVID, there will be even worse disasters in the future. But as a society, and I suspect as an individual, we're not so shocked by the figures or the pictures. When COVID first started, we were shocked when deaths in this country got to 100 a day. How many were yesterday and the last few weeks? More than that. But we're not shocked anymore. We've normalised. And I'm not saying whether that's right or wrong, but we've normalised things. And in the same way, people normalise bad leadership and behaviours. So they're not shocked, and they think that they're more acceptable. So when I look at this parable, I think it holds a really uncomfortable mirror to our society. Guessing that we don't have to look far to be able to think of examples. You know, think about that picture in here and think about what's around us, the way that people are exploited and violated, the way those who are innocent, the oppressed in here, suffer so much more. They're victims. What does it say about our response to the climate emergency, both individually and as a country. Think about how we treat those who are victims of human trafficking, those who are asylum seekers. What does it say about the developed world's response to sharing COVID vaccines and our decisions, which mean that those who are most vulnerable in the world, not only to the effects of COVID, but also the loss of infrastructure and the international aid that comes with that, are the ones who are least protected and most likely to suffer. And as I reflected on what this picture of society in this passage represents today, I think God wants us to be appalled and horrified, to hate it as much as he does, to speak out, to challenge, to do those things which are right. Because as Christians, we are called not to join in with the crowd. Micah says that we're to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly before God. And that brings us to the Good Shepherd. Because the contrast between the bad shepherds, the bad leaders, and God, the Good Shepherd, couldn't be starker. Whereas the bad shepherd exploited and sold the sheep for slaughter, exploiting those who were under his care, the Good Shepherd cared for the whole flock, particularly looking after those who were the weakest, the most vulnerable, the most in need. And it is, of course, in Jesus that we see the Good Shepherd personified, as he says about himself, "I am the Good Shepherd. I know my sheep and my sheep know me, just as the Father knows me and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep." Within that verse, there are two aspects of what that good shepherding that Jesus does looks like. The first is relationship. This is a two-way intimate relationship. Jesus knows his sheep, and his sheep know him. That image, that will have had far more power then than it does now. Because Middle Eastern shepherds lived with their flocks. They knew each sheep, they knew their characteristics. The sheep learnt to recognise the voice of their own shepherd, so that when the herds were mixed up, the shepherd would just walk through the flock and call. The sheep would recognise the voice and follow. And within this relationship, there's the promise that we will know God the Father in the same way that Jesus knows him. And the second is sacrificial, because Jesus declares that his purpose was to give his life for the flock and to express his Father's love for the world by giving up his own life so that we could be set free from sin, set free from the evil that we see described in this passage. The wording "good shepherd" doesn't actually do justice to the actual meaning of the original text, where "good" actually means beautiful, and it refers to the sheer attractiveness of what God does. It's not something that's mild and trite or sort of neutral. It's actually amazing. The good shepherd that Zechariah was acting out was amazing. He was dazzling. He was doing beautiful things. There would have been something so magnetic that when the good shepherd called, people would be attracted and drawn to him. But they weren't, were they? They rejected him. They detested him. And because of that, they received the punishment that they deserved. This chapter brings the challenge that when Jesus, the Messiah, came in the future, how were they going to respond? Would they reject him? Or would the compelling beauty and love of Jesus draw them to himself? And as I draw to a close, I think there's a challenge in it. That in this noisy world, in our complicated lives, that try and drown out Jesus, that try and drown out the voice of Jesus. Jesus, the good, beautiful shepherd, invites us to listen to him and to follow him. Ephesians 5 says, "Follow God's example, therefore, as dearly loved children, and walk in the way of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God." And there is a challenge to each of us. How do I hear his voice and follow him and stay close to him? And how do we help those around us to hear his voice? Our families, our friends, those we love, our communities. So just in a few moments of quiet, let's just quieten our hearts and our minds to ask him to help us hear his voice.